Did you watch Raw on Monday?
Did you watch Raw on Monday?
No, I never watched Raw. Why would I want to watch Raw?
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
I know that feeling, Paulie. I know. Happy Memorial Day weekend. This is episode 706 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, May 30th, 2021. I am the Solo Monster. It is Double or Nothing Sunday. Right now, you can save 20% off all shirts in our store on ProWrestlingTees.com. Solo Monster Sounds Off. Just use the code MEMORIAL at checkout during their Memorial Day sale, which ends tomorrow. And if you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. Like these fine folks here, as we close out the month of May, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Trevon the Cannon Clark, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Ostentatious Alan Carter, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, the Wichita Workhorse Clayton Nettleton, the Chicago Screamer Ian Noel Camelotes, the Firebomber Craig Foster, the Alabama Assassin Craig, Chris. I was trying to merge the two of them together. Chris Young. I'm going to have to pick Chris against Craig. The assassin and the firebomber, and see who comes out on top. Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, Crazy Like a Fox, Christian Caballero. The Melbourne Madman, Steve Kelly. Your friend Angela told me that you celebrated a birthday a few weeks ago. I know you've been working hard lately, so happy belated birthday, my friend. Don't work too hard. And thanks for being a fan of the show, Steve. I appreciate it. And that's a fact. Chris Foster. We have Craig Foster before, now we have Chris. I don't believe there's any relation. But Chris's Faxma YouTube channel, you heard me talk about that a couple of weeks ago. It asks the questions that you want answers to. It tries to provide a new understanding of familiar concepts. His latest video digs into the hypothetical evidence of reincarnation. Very interesting topic. You can search for Faxma, F-A-C-T-S-M-A, on YouTube. And I want to mention that a good friend of the podcast, a name that I know some of you at least are very familiar with, Kevin Castle, has a brand new show of his own called Castle and Chicky Podcast Adventures that you should check out. He and his co-host, Baseball Chicky, they have been friends for a very long time. And now they are doing a weekly show together, talking everything from music to classic TV, comedy, horror films, whatever else springs to mind. Their latest episode talks about the Naked Gun franchise. God, I do miss Leslie Nielsen. The show is part of the Rational Rage Network. You can subscribe to them on there and on all major podcast platforms. So check them out. And again, good luck to Kev with his new venture. I'm sure it'll be a smashing success. I'm going to have a few more shout-outs here in just a little bit. I do want to mention just a couple of things here before we get rolling, and there's a lot to roll into, not just AEW, although we'll start with AEW. But I heard from a whole bunch of different people, not everybody, but I know that some people have been having issues with the podcast either not popping up on Apple Podcasts or popping up very late in the day. Because the shows don't go up very late. So if ever, it's 5 o'clock on a Sunday and you're wondering, hey, where's the Sound Off? Is there a podcast? The answer is yes. And the show likely went up hours earlier, but it's probably an Apple issue. So I think what's been going on is the people who have been having problems, you very likely have updated your iOS to the latest version, probably 14.5 and above, which I have not yet done. I'm still at 14.4 on my phone. I don't think anybody who has not recently upgraded has had any issues. But it's an Apple issue. It should be resolved. If not, that again, it's an Apple issue. They're aware of it. If it's not already fixed, they're working on it. But if ever you run into that problem where it's not popping up and it's hours later, assume that the show is up. That's why I make sure I push it out to a whole bunch of different platforms. If one doesn't work, I guarantee you there's another three or four that will. So if Apple's not working for you one particular week, the show's probably up on Spotify. If you don't see it on Spotify, it's probably on Pandora. If it's not on Pandora, it's probably on iHeartRadio. Or check out the Podbean app. There's so many different ways to stream the show. Nobody should ever have to wait 6 hours or an entire day for the show to push out. But just so you know, it is an Apple issue. I'm hoping by now it's fixed, but if not, you do have other options. The Ultimate Warrior was featured on Dark Side of the Ring and A&E this week. I am going to do one giant review video talking about both documentaries. I have a lot of thoughts on both of these episodes this week, and I'll let you know which one I liked more, which one I thought was better, and all the stuff that was left out. Both of them left out a lot of stuff, I'm sure. In the case of Dark Side of the Ring, you know, there were time issues, but anyway, that'll be going up on YouTube, if not today, then by tomorrow. So we're going to keep that separate, and if you want to check out all the Warrior stuff, you'll be able to do so separately on the YouTube channel. If you are a YouTube channel member, first of all, thank you. I appreciate that. If you are a YouTube channel member, so you know, a few hours ago, I put a post up in the community section on the YouTube channel asking you for your Q&A, because I'm going to be recording another Q&A video this week, maybe on Wednesday, asking questions from you that I can answer. The thread is up in the community section. I know you don't always get alerted, so I'm alerting you now. If you want to submit a question, go to the post and just leave your question in the comments section. Again, that's the next members-only Q&A. It'll be going up this week. I'm turning it over to you guys. And again, I thank you for all of your support. AEW Dynamite aired live on Friday night this week, but I still streamed on Wednesday with my Double or Nothing predictions, which I'll run through again in a second. My final predictions for tonight's show. Dynamite is going to be preempted again this week to Friday at 10 p.m., and depending on how the NBA playoffs work out, it could end up being preempted almost the entire month of June. That would mean Friday airings on June 11th and June 18th, with a live Dynamite scheduled for Saturday, June 26th, if it gets preempted that week, and then back in its usual Wednesday slot on June 30th. Now, the good news is that they're back on the road right after that, and I think that's going to be a positive ratings-wise for both WWE and AEW when that happens, at least for the first few weeks. But you never want to be booted out of your usual time slot for an entire month. I mean, 1 week, 2 weeks, I mean, that's bad enough, especially coming out of a pay-per-view. But if they end up getting preempted pretty much the entire month of June, that's awful. I mean, that's brutal. But a lot of that is going to depend on how the NBA schedule works out. But I did watch Dynamite on Friday. They had a new setup for Daly's Place, which was really the old setup that they used there pre-pandemic. That's the way it's going to be set up for the pay-per-view tonight. They had fans back at ringside. They had the one tunnel open with the one ramp to the tunnel. I thought it looked great. Hot crowd. It was so nice. I've been waiting so long for this. Just to get people back at ringside and not have them up in the bleachers and have all the wrestlers fake singing along to Chris Jericho's music every week. So it was nice. It was nice to have a hot crowd that was hungry for some wrestling. They brought out Paul White during one of the segments for the weigh-in with Cody Rhodes and Anthony Ogogo for their match tonight. Now, they've teased issues on Dark Elevation recently with Paul White and QT Marshall, who was also in the ring for this. So that's something to watch for in the Battle Royal tonight if Paul White was to be the mystery entrant. He's going to be doing commentary, but he's my pick as far as just, you know, getting up in the middle of the match and coming in and being the surprise. I could be wrong. I could be wrong. There is quite a bit of chatter about some other potential names who could end up in that spot. But I just wanted to bring this up because this, I'm not against the idea of doing a weigh-in. And we've seen weigh-ins done before in lieu of a contract signing. And, you know, it's the sort of thing you see before a big boxing fight or a big MMA fight. It adds a degree, I guess, of realism to things, even though they don't really make that big of a deal about weight classes in pro wrestling. It is a little bit silly. But I thought that this weigh-in, I thought this entire segment absolutely sucked. I thought this was terrible. And what made it worse is poor Big Show is in there. He's trying to weigh these guys on a traditional scale. They didn't have a digital scale. I don't know why you wouldn't just have a digital one. So he's trying to like weigh these guys and he doesn't know what the fuck he's doing, or he can't get like an accurate measurement. So he's standing there. People are getting bored. Some people are starting to boo. I'm booing, watching from home. This entire segment, I thought, was a complete fucking fail. And it might have been a nice idea in theory, but this was a total waste of time. Hangman Page comes out in front of a packed crowd at Daly's place. Already feels like a bigger deal again. Just being back in front of people. He beat Joey Janela. He ended up covered in blood. I didn't even see how it happened. He had busted his mouth open, but right before the finish, when he hit the Buckshot Lariat, the blood started to pour from a wound on top of his head. And again, I didn't see how it happened, but man, by the end of all this, there was blood coming down his face. He looked like he was in a fucking barroom brawl. Team Taz came out, and Hangman got up in his face, blood covering his entire face, and he tells him, "Face me like a man on Sunday. Leave your friends in the back." Which Cage said that he would do. So the match between them tonight should be kept one-on-one. Jade Cargill has seemingly accepted Mark Sterling's offer to be her new manager. He said that he only gets paid when she wins, which she did on this show. She picked up a win over Kylan King. I'm hoping this is just a swerve until she reveals her real manager, Selena De La Renta. That's what I would do. I would try, I would make a play for Selena De La Renta. You bring her in and let her not just manage Jade Cargill, but potentially build up her own little faction like she had in MLW. Miro, who already feels like a bigger deal with that belt around his waist. He beat Dante Martin of Top Flight. We had Jake Roberts and Lance Archer come out for some promo time when the match was over. Big brawl broke out between the two guys. I'm looking forward to that match tonight. Just two big guys looking to beat the shit out of each other. That's one of the matches tonight I'm looking forward to. Tony Schiavone was in the ring to present Hikaru Shida with a brand new diamond-encrusted women's championship belt. Did I not just say on Wednesday? I begged AEW on my prediction stream on Wednesday, please, get a new women's belt. It is too small. It's not even that it's that ugly. It's too small. Get a new women's belt. Well, ask and ye shall receive. This one does not really look all that different. Same basic shape. It's got more gold color to it. But it is bigger. That's really all I asked for. So, can't complain. I got what I wanted. She will not have long to enjoy it, though. Britt Baker came out, said the previous era was the 316 era. This will be the era of DMD. And indeed it will be. Now, during one of the commercials, the Spanish language announcers got caught on a hot mic. Caused a huge stir on social media when the audio was leaked online. I guess it was from the Fight TV feed, I believe. Willie Urbina, Alex Abrahantes, Dasha, and Thunder Rosa. They were doing commentary. And Urbina was caught mocking Hikaru Shida's accent during a segment where they were honoring her, no less. Of all the times. This was a segment meant to honor her in her one-year reign as women's champion. And Abrahantes, who has been used as a manager for Penta in recent weeks, he can be heard telling Urbina to do Shida, as in translate her promo. And Urbina proceeds to do a very stereotypical imitation of an Asian accent. And I'm just thinking, you know, how dumb do you have to be? Do they not teach these people to always treat your microphone like it's live and that people can hear you? Always assume that the mic is hot. And don't act like a dingbat when you're on the job. You want to act like a dingbat behind closed doors? Do what you want. But when you're at work and when you're at the commentary desk, you got to be a professional. And this guy's done commentary for years. He's done commentary for other promotions. He's done commentary in the past for TNA many years ago. So this is not his first rodeo. This is all shit that he should know. And now he's out of a job. Because the next morning, AEW fired him. I hope it was worth it. Ethan Page and Scorpio Sky beat Evil Uno and Stu Grayson after the match was over. Darby Allin came out with an army of men wearing Sting masks, and they ran the same angle they did with Sting in WCW, and again years later in TNA, where the real Sting pulls off the fake Sting mask. It's just basically a fucking inside joke at this point. And in the main event segment, they had Eric Bischoff making another appearance here on Dynamite, although I think this is his first one in front of actual fans. And he was the master of ceremonies for the Inner Circle celebration. Since the Inner Circle is in jeopardy of being broken up forever if they lose the Stadium Stampede match tonight, they did this entire segment celebrating them and teasing that this could potentially be the end, which it could be. This could potentially be the end of the group. And Bischoff pointed out that it was 25 years ago, the night before, on this very network, TNT, that he introduced what would become maybe the greatest faction of all time, talking about the NWO. So he brought out another great faction, he said, in the Inner Circle. And this is the first time that you had the full crowd doing the Judas entrance for Jericho's music. They played a video package showing highlights of the Inner Circle, which was formed pretty much on day one when Dynamite came on the air. And each person spoke. Santana cut this very passionate promo. And again, I like it when they give him more airtime because he's very good. Ortiz just... all Ortiz had to say was, that was beautiful. And he gave him a fist bump and that was it. Jake Hager spoke. The less said about that, the better. Sammy Guevara said they've been through everything together. And when he quit the Inner Circle, he didn't like that feeling at all. And he's going to do everything in his power to make sure that never happens again. And then Jericho spoke and talked about how, you know, he wasn't sold on the idea of a group. He doesn't really play well with others. But these guys, it was just a natural connection they had. And at Stadium Stampede, if they lose, they're going to go down in a blaze of glory. He said, I love you. They all hugged. They all flipped off the camera. MJF popped up on the video board. He was mocking them. He stepped aside, and behind him we saw Dean Malenko. Jericho's good friend, Dean Malenko, had been beaten up by the Pinnacle. And they were on the field, at TIAA Field next door. They were on the football field. So we cut back to the Inner Circle, and they're making a beeline out of Daly's place. They're trying to run over to the stadium next door. Of course, it was an ambush. So they get attacked, and they did this double pile driver spot from inside the stadium, stuffed pile drivers through tables. The Pinnacle was left standing when this was over. And that was your go home episode of Dynamite leading into tonight. Tonight is Double or Nothing 3, live from Daly's Place in Jacksonville at 8 p.m. Eastern. I will be live on YouTube immediately after the show is over. So I hope you'll join me for the full recap. WrestleRumble.com is hosting not one but two AEW contests. Entries are open through tonight for the Double or Nothing Pick'em contest. Top prize is $1,000 cash. And so that's definitely something you want to get on before it's too late. You go to WrestleRumble.com. You can buy your entries on the sidebar. And then it's the Great American Belt Bash. We're giving away belts to five different winners, including John Cena's Spinner U.S. title, as well as the current WWE United States Championship, the retired United States Championship, the IWGP US title, and the old WCW US title. It's only a buck to enter, $1. So you have until tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern when the pay-per-view starts to sign up. I'm going to be picking the winners live on my review stream tonight at random. It could be you. So tune in and go to WrestleRumble.com before time runs out and make sure you enter either or both contests. Now, AEW announced the buy-in pre-show match is going to be Serena Deeb defending her NWA Women's Championship against the very first AEW Women's Champion, Riho. Serena just came back recently. She was on the shelf with a knee injury for 3 months. The last time these two were in the ring together, Serena's knee was already hurt, and they had a very good match. So now that she's 100% or near 100%, imagine what kind of match these two will have today, as opposed to the one they had back in February. Riho got the win in that match. I don't see history repeating itself here. We're not going to get a title change. My prediction is that Serena retains her NWA title. We have the Casino Battle Royal with the winner earning a future AEW World title match. I'm going with Christian Cage. He's probably the most predictable pick, but I think in this case, predictable makes sense. He'll have that world title shot tucked away in his back pocket for whenever they want him to use it and have that big match, him against Kenny Omega, probably at some point this summer. I don't know if they would wait until All Out or if they would want to do it maybe as a big TV main event before then, but we're definitely going to get a Kenny Omega-Christian Cage match. This would be the quickest and easiest way for him to basically just bank a world title match that they can dust off whenever they're ready. You know, maybe they'll do it in a few weeks. Who knows? But they do save one spot, usually, for the Joker slot, the surprise entrant at the very end. It's usually number 21 in these things. I'm going with Paul White. You know, Paul White's going to be doing commentary for the Battle Royal. He's had these little issues recently with QT Marshall, who is in the Battle Royal as well. So, you know, my thought is he gets up from the announce desk because he is going to be wrestling at some point. It's in his contract. He hasn't wrestled yet, but he will be stepping in the ring. And I see him getting in the ring and disposing of QT. And then they can have some of QT's guys, you know, maybe somebody like a Nick Camarado or something, give him a big elimination, dumping Paul White out over the top rope, because he's not going to win. So that's my thought as far as the surprise slot is concerned. There are reportedly some surprises planned for the pay-per-view tonight, and one name that I have seen floating around is Andrade, who was in talks with AEW some time ago. So, I mean, I don't think you can discount the possibility of the mystery man being Andrade. He is scheduled to challenge Kenny Omega for the AAA Mega title at Triple Mania in August. Maybe he enters the Battle Royal here, and maybe he wins. They could do something with him and Omega in AEW as well. But I'm going to stick with Christian as my pick to win. Hangman Page against Brian Cage. Cage had gotten a kind of a shock win many weeks ago on Dynamite over Hangman, and this is the rematch here between these two. I'm picking Hangman to win, get his win back, slowly build him back up again for his eventual championship match with Kenny Omega. We've got the American Dream, the American Dream, Cody Rhodes. He would like to believe that he is Dusty Rhodes. For one night, he is going to be Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. Cody goes one-on-one with Anthony Ogogo. Cody has been feuding with QT Marshall and the Nightmare Factory folks for a while. Not really been a fan of this feud. But there's a big spot for Ogogo. They're really trying to build him up as a killer. He has not had any matches longer than maybe 90 seconds on television. We still don't know exactly what he can do in the ring other than just throw a punch. It's kind of what he does. Cody is calling himself the American Dream. He's fighting for America. He did the big patriotic promo a few weeks ago. Everything is set up for him to win. But I don't think he does. I don't think he should. Anthony Ogogo, he's the guy they're building up. Then Anthony Ogogo should win this match. Cody loses nothing by taking the L here. You want to build this guy up, you give him a win. So I'm picking Ogogo. Miro defends the TNT title against Lance Archer. And like I said, this is one of the matches I'm looking forward to tonight. Just two big guys talking shit and cutting promos on each other every week, like street talking each other. They're going to go in there. They're going to have a giant brawl. I don't think this has to have a decisive finish, because I don't think this is going to be the only match between these two. And it is a TNT title match. It probably has a time limit. I don't know how long, if it's 10 or 20 minutes. But you could easily have them just brawl to the time limit or brawl all over the building until they get counted out and then build to a rematch on TV in a few weeks. But I don't think either one of these guys should be losing. Now, at some point, you know, someone's going to have to win, and it's going to be Miro, because Miro is not losing the TNT title. So if anybody wins this match, it is going to be Miro. But I'm going to say that there is a non-finish that leads to a rematch in a few weeks between these two. We've got Sting and Darby Allin taking on Ethan Page and Scorpio Sky. This is Sting's first live match in front of an audience since his match with Seth Rollins at Night of Champions in 2015. It will not be cinematic. The last time they had a match together, it was cinematic. It was a few months ago against Team Taz, and Sting and Darby came out with the victory. I just can't see Sting in his first proper match in 6 years, and Darby coming off a big loss, you know, dropping the TNT title to Miro, and he's one of the most over guys in the entire company, is Darby. I see a rebound here for him, and I don't see Sting losing in his first real match in 6 years. So I'm picking the baby faces to go over here, but this, I think this is one of the more unpredictable matches on the card, because it could go either way. They could be of a different mindset and kind of like I am with Cody and Agogo and say, we got to put the new guys over. Got to put the young guys over. And maybe they will. But I just feel like the baby faces are getting the win here. And coming out of this, we'll still have singles matches on TV. You'll have Darby against Ethan Page and Darby against Scorpio Sky. I don't know if Sting will do any television matches, but I think he's getting the win here. We have Shida defending her AEW Women's Championship against Dr. Britt Baker, DMD. It was 1 year ago at this very event that Shida won the title from Nyla Rose, and she's gotten wins ever since over much of the roster. Penelope Ford, Thunder Rosa, Abaddon, Big Swole, Anna Jay, Rio Mizunami, who won that Women's Eliminator Tournament a few months ago, Ty Conti. Britt Baker had the best match of her life against Thunder Rosa, that lights out match a few months ago. And ever since then, she's been on a win streak. She's become the number one contender. She really has been the face. You know, when she first came into the company, she was sort of the face of the women's division in AEW. Her and Nyla Rose has yet to be champion, though. But her turning heel last year was gigantic as far as that being a turning point for her. And she's really settled very nicely into the role. She's improved. She was very good. Those first few matches that Britt Baker was having, her first few months in AEW, not very good. But this is a slam dunk. This is the easiest pick on the entire show outside of the main event. Britt Baker is going to win. And Britt Baker is going to be your new women's champion. Jon Moxley and Eddie Kingston challenge the Young Bucks for the AEW Tag Team titles. Bucks have been champions since November. They have since turned heel. Like Britt Baker, it's the role for them. They're just so easily dislikable that they just come across so much more naturally as heels on this show. Moxley and Kingston, I love the pairing. I don't want to see it end yet. I see absolutely no reason why you can't take the belts off the Bucks and put them on Moxley and Kingston. I know Moxley's having a kid. Renee, I think, is due June 11th or something. That's only a few weeks away. Maybe he'll be off television for a couple of weeks. Who knows? But even still, I'm picking Moxley and Kingston to get the win, and they are the new tag team champions. Inner Circle and the Pinnacle, second ever Stadium Stampede match. If the Inner Circle loses, they must disband forever. And said, you know, many times before, I said the Pinnacle, they're the new group that you are building up. They got the win in the Blood and Guts match. I think the order of doing this is very bizarre. I would have done this match first. This would have been the first meeting between these two groups tonight. And then you build to a Blood and Guts match on television in the rematch. They chose to go a different way, especially with fans now coming back to the buildings in July. I would have held off. They chose to go in a different direction. The Pinnacle already got a win. Now, if the plan is to do a three-match series, then the Inner Circle would have to win. And then you would do the rubber match in July, or maybe if they want to hold off until August, and they kind of blow it off at All Out, where they build to a singles match between Jericho and MJF, which I think we still probably will end up getting. I don't know that the entire feud is over after tonight. But I got to go with the Pinnacle. The Pinnacle should be winning this match. What's better than getting a win over the Inner Circle? Getting two wins over the Inner Circle, which feels like to me they've done all they can do. That group, yeah, you can keep them together. They could still be associated with each other and still go off and do their own thing. But if you're going to do that, you may as well just break them up. Let Santana and Ortiz go dominate the tag team division. Let Sammy go do his thing. Jericho can go off and do his thing. I've seen people say, oh, well, he's going to take time off anyway for Fozzy. No, he's not. He is planning on going back on tour with Fozzy, but he has, I believe, structured his touring schedule to allow him to still be on TV every week. I don't believe he has any Wednesday dates. So, you know, look, if he's going to go back and do Fozzy stuff, he's still going to be able to be on Dynamite every week. That has nothing to do with any of this. But I'm picking the Pinnacle. If it's me, the Pinnacle goes over again in this match. And this is the end of the Inner Circle. And then we have the main event. Kenny Omega defending the AEW World Championship at a triple threat against Pac and Orange Cassidy. First triple threat main event on an AEW pay-per-view. This should be a excellent match. You know, we know what Pac can do in the ring with Omega. Orange Cassidy and Kenny Omega have never been in the ring together before. But I think this will end up being an excellent match. Kenny Omega, I mean, it's just not in doubt. Kenny Omega is going to retain. He's going to still be the AEW World Champion when this is over. But I think Pac is going to be the one to take the losing fall here. And I think that keeps things a little bit open with Orange Cassidy, where they could come back in a little bit and do a singles match if they want with him and Kenny Omega. They can get a singles match out of it. So I think because of that, they sort of protect him by not having him take the losing fall. He is still very over. I mean, you saw the reaction he got at Daly's Place on Friday night when he was out there. You don't have to like the guy, but clearly the AEW fans do. And if you are the promoter, if you are Tony Khan, then you push the guy who's over. But you're not going to push him into a world title because Kenny Omega should not be losing the world title just yet. So he is my pick to retain. And that's your Double or Nothing card. Again, I'll be live on YouTube when it's all over. On paper, there's some strong matches. We'll see. Yeah, it's good. I think it'll be fun. It'll be loud. You know, it'll be very different than the atmosphere for last year's show, which was basically in front of no one. I will not miss that. The days of the Performance Center in front of no one. The Thunderdome. You know, now that we know people are coming back and they're leaving these cities and they're going back on the road, I find myself being very impatient. I'm looking at the calendar. I'm like, it's not even June. We have to wait until July. I'm growing very impatient with the Thunderdome. But in due time, we will find out who's really over and who's not, which is the biggest reason why I want people back in the buildings. I don't want to leave those decisions just to the promoters. Those decisions should be made by the fans. We haven't had that for the past year. But one more bit of AEW news, because this also turned into a controversy. Everything turns into a controversy these days. If you look at somebody cross-eyed, it's a controversy. And they want to cancel you, and they want to pile on you. It's just the nature of, unfortunately, the nature of how things are today. But Jim Ross was being dragged by AEW fans on social media this week for a comment that he made on his Grilling JR podcast, saying that he thought Randy Orton was the best wrestler in the business today. This is what he said. I don't think anybody is any better than Randy Orton in the wrestling business. Of course, that's so subjective. I love Randy's work, although I don't watch it regularly enough to make a great evaluation. In the last several months that I have tuned in to watch some of his segments, he doesn't disappoint. No matter how the creative is packaged to him, he does not disappoint. I'm sure there's Kenny Omega fans out there that would say Omega is the best wrestler in the world. Some will, and they got the right to their opinion, and I'm not going to argue it. Now, this also made some AEW people in the company unhappy, that he would put over a WWE guy as being the best in the world. And he later clarified his comments and addressed the backlash that he got for his opinion. Apparently, I said that I thought Randy Orton was the best wrestler in the world. People forget that I recruit these guys. I had a business association with a guy like Randy Orton since day one. Coach Barry Switzer once said, "You recruit these kids for life," and I kind of take that to heart. Apparently, people thought I was besmirching Kenny Omega, that I was dissing Kenny. Nothing could be further from the truth. I can have many opinions on this question, many answers, and today my flavor of the day was Randy Orton. I really don't get it. I don't get what the inflammation is regarding this topic that is so subjective. There is no right or wrong. He is the best in the world based on what? Arm drags? Drop toe holds? Money drawn? Major event headlines? Tenure? What is the criteria? TV ratings? I don't know what the criteria is for these things, but anybody that can debate me and tell me that Randy Orton is not one of the best wrestlers in the world will have a hard time winning their argument. Anybody can debate me and say, well, I think Kenny Omega is. Well, if you make a good point that I don't have any problem with that, Kenny Omega is the AEW champion. He's a hell of a hand. There's no doubt about it. And a lot of people took issue with Omega being labeled a hell of a hand. Because, you know, very often that's used, or like a good hand, right? That's used for people who are good to have around or put other people over, but you don't usually hear that expression used for someone of, you know, of like a really elite caliber. I mean, AEW based an entire storyline around this very thing when Sean Spears debuted and he turned on Cody Rhodes for calling him a good hand. So I can understand people kind of grimacing at that comment. But just the level of vitriol directed at JR for having a fucking opinion was so over the top. It highlighted how tribalist a lot of the fans are. I mean, we already knew that. You see it every day. And that's not just an AEW thing. But there are a lot of AEW fans who are very tribalist. AEW is their home team. And if you say the slightest thing out of turn, they don't like that. Trust me. Trust me. They don't like that. They go on the attack. Jim Ross is entitled to his opinion. He also has a podcast where he is free to express those opinions. There are a lot of things that you can fairly criticize Jim Ross for. If you don't think he's the same announcer he once was, or some of the cringeworthy comments he'll make on television from time to time, it's fair game. But for having an opinion about who he thinks is the best wrestler in the world, get over it. Get over yourself. And besides, they're both wrong. Clearly, the correct answer right now is the tribal chief. At least until Okada heals up from that bad back. Then my answer would be different. But until then, all hail the tribal chief. Acknowledge him. Got some more shout-outs here. A few months ago, you heard me talk about the Game Mode Retro YouTube channel, which features game reviews, unboxings, and gameplay videos. And many of you responded by checking it out, which is what I like to hear. We have a very diverse audience here on the Sound Off. A lot of gamers here. The channel has two featured series, Game Mode Retro versus Retro Comparisons, which is now in its third season. It's a weekly competition series between two different YouTube channels that go head-to-head playing retro games. They have another series called Play Retro, which features live gameplay and discussion. They are huge wrestling fans. If you did not check them out before, I want you to check them out now. They get the Solomonster seal of approval. You know, you've heard of the Good Housekeeping seal of approval? Fuck Good Housekeeping. You want the Solomonster seal of approval. So go check out Game Mode Retro on YouTube. And Deluxeman, Alex, which is a name I know some of you are familiar with, has a new music video out titled 911. It is a fundraiser for the Equal Justice Initiative, EJI, honoring Black lives lost to police brutality and suppression. I know this cause is very important to him. and it is worthy of your attention. He is a talented musician as well, as you can see with this video when you check it out. So I hope you will. I hope you will check it out and show him support. You can find it on his YouTube channel, Just Alex. That's the title of it, Just Alex, A-L-Y-X. Or if you type in 911 Alex, so that's 911 and then A-L-Y-X into the YouTube search bar, it'll be the first thing that comes up. So please go check out his video, 911. WWE announced on Friday that SummerSlam will take place on a Saturday this year, August 21st, from a summer destination location that will be revealed during the 2021 Belmont Stakes pre-race show next Saturday on NBC. Sports Business Daily says they are holding the event at an NFL stadium to be determined, which would be the first time SummerSlam has ever been held at an NFL stadium. The last big stadium they ran for SummerSlam was Wembley in the UK in 1992. Belmont is in New York. So if it wasn't for all of this stadium talk, I would say that they would announce it for Madison Square Garden, which I think would be a great place to do it. I like the idea of a summer destination outdoors, maybe, or like a big stadium for SummerSlam, but I don't know. To do a big MSG show coming out of the pandemic, bring it back to New York, I like that idea. Doesn't sound like that's going to happen, but the night before SummerSlam, they have a show in Phoenix, and the night after the pay-per-view, they have a super show in Denver. So they're not flying West Coast to East Coast and back. That would be ridiculous. Per Andrew Zarian of the Mat Men podcast, it's going to be Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas. But there is also a Manny Pacquiao fight that night in Vegas at one of the smaller arenas. That has not yet been announced which building that's going to be in. And look, I don't care if Pacquiao is not the star or the draw that he once was. A big boxing fight, especially a big boxing fight in Vegas, will always trump pro wrestling. Even if WWE runs a bigger building, they have a crowd twice as large, three times as large, it doesn't matter. In the media, a big boxing fight will always be treated more, like a bigger deal than a pro wrestling event will be. That's just the way it is. Even if Pacquiao is not the star he once was, 10 years ago. Doesn't matter. So running head-to-head in the same market with a Pacquiao fight seems very unwise to me. But they could always run. I guess they could run earlier in the day if they want. I mean, they used to run pay-per-views at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. East Coast time. They did that with WrestleMania 10. But they are reportedly planning a huge main event. And the big name rumored to be brought in as the guest host, per Andrew Zarian, is Cardi B, whose song Up is the official theme song for SummerSlam this year. And, hey, she used to be a WWE fan during the Ruthless Aggression era. She's tweeted about that before. She said Stone Cold was retired by the time she started watching, but her favorites used to be Batista and Booker T and Eddie Guerrero and Edge and Triple H and Lita. Beyond the song, though, her involvement has not yet been confirmed. Again, that's just a rumor at this point, but they are planning a big name, and she would fit the bill. The other rumor going around is that the big match plan, the big main event plan for SummerSlam this year, is Roman Reigns defending his Universal Championship against John Cena, who is wrapping up filming on his Suicide Squad spinoff. Early in July, he's been up in Vancouver for months filming. That's why he said he couldn't be at WrestleMania this year. He said logistically, he's up in Vancouver. I can't be in two places at once, otherwise I would be there. So he's wrapping up at the beginning of July, and it would make sense to get him back on that first show in front of fans on July 16th, which is the live SmackDown before Money in the Bank, to maybe start setting that up. Cena against Reigns is one of the biggest matches that they could do with the current roster at this point. It's been 4 years since they had their one and only singles match on pay-per-view, which had Cena putting Reigns over. But things are very different now. Roman is in the middle of this great heel run. The outcome should not be any different than it was back then. But if you could do Cena versus Reigns in a stadium with the story of John Cena going for title number 17, trying to dethrone the tribal chief, I think that would be huge. I want them to get Brock Lesnar back for the show, for a match with Bobby Lashley. That way you get two big matches out of it. And then you got the story of how would Paul Heyman fit into things with Lesnar in one match on one brand and Roman in the other on the other brand. I think that could be a very interesting story in itself. And then you do the rematch between Sasha Banks and Bianca Belair on that show too. I mean, that was one of your WrestleMania main events this year. So doing that match, doing the big rematch between them at SummerSlam, I think as far as the women's matches go, is probably the biggest women's match they could do there on that side. Now, Cena was involved in a big controversy this week. I just got done talking about two controversies, right? Willie Urbina, Jim Ross, and now John Cena. Involved in a big controversy this week, which is not something you've heard. I don't think you've ever heard me say that before on this podcast. John Cena is not one to be involved, typically, in anything controversial. He is as... Frankly, when I think of John Cena, and you think of other names over the years, and they've gotten into trouble, or they've been involved in controversial things, or they've made controversial public statements, or whatever. John Cena, the word I think of is clinical. It's a very clinical, I don't know, very vanilla, very boring. You don't really hear him being involved in stuff like... It's why Vince McMahon probably loved him so much. That and all the merch he sold. But he was involved in a controversy this week. Although Michael Cole used to use that word about John Cena all the time. He used to call him the most controversial name in WWE. Polarizing, Michael. Polarizing. The word is polarizing. But it started when Cena was being interviewed on a TV network in Taiwan while promoting the new Fast and the Furious film, and he said that Taiwan was the first country to watch the film. Right? It's a very innocent statement. Well, that did not sit well with China, which believes that Taiwan will one day be unified with the mainland. They do not believe that Taiwan is its own independent country. And for over 70 years, Taiwan has governed itself. So Cena stepped on a political landmine that I'm sure he had no idea about when he made the comment. It was an innocent comment. And then, no doubt, due to pressure from the movie studio, he recorded a short apology video that looked more like a hostage video. You would think President Xi was standing off camera holding a gun to his head. In the video, Cena spoke in Mandarin, which he learned while he was in WWE, when WWE was looking to expand its business into China. Here's the translation from the South China Morning Post. Hi China, I'm John Cena. I'm in the middle of Fast and Furious 9 promotions. I'm doing a lot of interviews. I made a mistake in one of my interviews. Everyone was asking me if I could use Chinese. The movie staff gave me a lot of information, so there was a lot of interviews and information. I made one mistake. I have to say something very, very, very important now. I love and respect China and Chinese people. I'm very, very sorry about my mistake. I apologize. I apologize. I'm very sorry. You must understand that I really love, really respect China and the Chinese people. My apologies. See you. He never said what he was apologizing for, but he apologized so many times you would think that his wife found steamy texts on his phone from Nikki Bella. Not exactly a profile in courage is John Cena, nor is anybody debating the fact that he has great respect for China. But again, he never specified what he was apologizing for, but boy, did he apologize. Over and over and over again. But this is the LeBron James thing all over again. When LeBron said that the GM of the Houston Rockets was misinformed when he tweeted his support for the protesters in Hong Kong, and then he talked about the GM only thinking about himself and not the ramifications it can have on others, he saw billions of dollars potentially being flushed down the toilet at a time when the NBA was trying to make inroads in China. With Cena, you know, the Fast and Furious movie that he's in, which I think comes out here in the States next month, It already made $137 million in its first week in China. Those movies make billions of dollars. That franchise is a fucking cash cow for Universal. And the majority of that money comes out of the Asian market, and they know that. So they forced him to apologize, or they compelled him to apologize. That's exactly what happened here. There's not a doubt in my mind. Now, could he have said no? Yeah, of course he could have. He could have turned around and said, go fuck yourself. But how many people would do that? When you're in that position, I know it's easy to sit there and say, well, I would have said no. You know, look, I'd like to think I would have done the same thing. But when push comes to shove and, you know, you're in that position, and it's not just, you know, your career, but you have pressure that, look, you know, if this isn't fixed, it could affect all of us, and it could affect the studio, and it could affect, you know, all these different things. You have to apologize. This is all your fault. I mean, I'm sure there was an enormous amount of pressure on him. I'm not going to pile on him. I'm not going to cancel him or any of this other nonsense. You know, he's a product of the system that employs him and pays his salary. He's looking at his career potentially hanging in the balance. And it shouldn't be that way. I mean, it kind of sounds overly dramatic to say that, but I mean, if you really look at how invested all of these studios and companies are in that Asian market, and in China specifically, it's not that far-fetched at all. That's why they're all so scared. And I'm sure WWE wasn't too thrilled about it at the same time that they're trying to bring this guy back. But this will largely be forgotten. Cena will be fine. I don't see it affecting anything he does with WWE in a couple of months. People won't even be talking about this anymore. I'm not saying you can't criticize the man. Criticize away. But some of the comments directed at him are completely over the top. He doesn't want to see his movie career thrown away over one comment. Over one innocent comment. Again, I think having him as part of the SummerSlam card is smart business. Cena versus Reigns, if that's the match, it is a big attraction. It's only been done once before, and that was on a B-level pay-per-view because that was the only time they had Cena for to do it. He had to go off, I think, and film another movie. So it's a match that belongs on a big stadium show, not at No Mercy, and it gives Roman Reigns another big name to beat. Now, WWE also announced all of the remaining events as part of its 25-city summer tour. If you are hoping to attend a show, listen up. These are the dates in the cities. I'm going to run through them real quick here. Starting with Friday, July 23rd, SmackDown in Cleveland. And the next night, there's a super show in Pittsburgh. Then from there, they go to Louisville, Kansas City, Minneapolis at the Target Center, Milwaukee, Detroit, Chicago. They're coming to the Allstate Arena for Raw on August 2nd. Tampa, Florida, Fort Myers, Florida, Gainesville, Orlando, Tulsa at the, the Bach Center? Is that what it's called? Or is it BOK? What is Bach? What the fuck is Bach? I'm sure that's short for something. But the Bach Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma on August 13th. Charlotte, North Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, San Antonio, Phoenix, SummerSlam, of course, will be on Saturday, August 21st. The Ball Arena in Denver the next night. San Diego, North Little Rock, Arkansas, Oklahoma City, Jacksonville. Very interesting. Coming to Jacksonville on September 3rd. And then Raw at the American Airlines Arena in Miami on September 6th. WWE back on the road. Whereas Chris Farley said in Tommy Boy, Road, when he was all hopped up on whatever it was that he was hopped on. I don't even remember. It was him and David Spade in the car. They were all fucked up on something. Helium, I don't remember what it was. Great movie, though. Dave Meltzer, in this week's Wrestling Observer, reported on a potentially huge story, one that PW Insider later threw some cold water on. But it's fun to talk about this stuff. He claims that WWE President Nick Khan has been in discussions with New Japan Pro Wrestling, going back to at least late March or early April, about the possibility of the two sides working together with WWE becoming the exclusive American partner of New Japan. which has sent talent in recent months to both AEW and Impact Wrestling. He reported that any deal would include WWE sending talent, including top names, to work in New Japan. And with Nick Khan, he says the former isolationist attitude of WWE against everyone is changing, with the idea that WWE is part of the wrestling landscape and not separate from it, which is, I laughed when I read that. This completely flies in the face of how WWE has operated and what Vince McMahon has flat out said. Vince McMahon and George Barrios on some of those investor calls over the years that, you know, they hate being lumped in with pro wrestling. They resent it. Because to them, we're not just a wrestling company. We do so much more. We're an entertainment and media empire. So they resent the fact that people just kind of lump them in as the wrestling company. All of a sudden, though, they want to be part of the pro wrestling landscape. Let me translate that for you. Any deal that WWE were to do with New Japan is going to be done for one of two reasons. Or both. To use them as something of an NXT Japan to feed them Japanese talent, and to prevent them from working with All Elite Wrestling and any other promotions. That is it. It has nothing to do with them suddenly wanting to embrace their pro wrestling roots or this great desire to work with others. You think Nick Khan is coming in with the idea that, well, we should be part of the pro wrestling landscape? He's not a wrestling guy. He doesn't give a shit about that. He's there to make money. He's there to make deals and make money. All the cuts we heard about this week, dozens and dozens of staff cuts in the office and people being cut from behind the scenes and stuff. It's like a bloodbath in that company. Who would want to work there? Stories about people that have worked there for 10, 15, 20 years who were very well liked and were very important in their roles just cut because to them, when you have a big company like that, and that's the problem when you work for a big company, it's not just WWE, it's corporate America. You're a faceless number. And when they want to get things below a certain level and they feel like, well, we have to tighten the belt a little bit, it doesn't matter who you are, you're just some nameless, faceless person. And you don't matter to them. Why would anybody want to work for a company like that? No matter how much you contribute, no matter how good you do and perform, to have to always live in fear that, well, the next wave of cuts, I might be swept up in it no matter what kind of job I've done. It's ridiculous. But he's been overseeing all of that. He's trying to cut costs and, you know, boy, it sure, you know, a lot of people have said the same thing and it looks that way to me too. You know, you make a lot of these moves when you're getting a company ready for a potential sale. No indication that anything like that is on the horizon in the immediate future, but boy, it sure does look like they're making things look real good in case a potential sale is coming in the next couple of years. You know, again, does Nick Khan care about WWE being part of the pro wrestling landscape? No. No, why would he care? There's always an ulterior motive involved. Whether the story is true or not, I will say this Nick Khan is a pretty savvy guy. And I'm sure he has ambitions that are far bigger than just WWE, as evidenced by all of the moves I just mentioned and merging of all of these different departments within the company. That's going to look great on his resume when he saves the company all of this money and he moves on to his next corporate gig, or if they sell the company to the highest bidder. I've never been more convinced than I am today that WWE is going to be sold within the next 3 to 5 years. Whether it's to NBC Universal or someone else, I've never been more convinced, just based on all of the available evidence and just call it a gut feeling, that WWE is going to be sold in these next few years. That's part of the reason why this guy was put in the position that he was put in. The New Japan thing, I think it's smart because it would make WWE more attractive to potential new signees who might want to work dates for New Japan and may avoid signing with other promotions like an AEW, who typically might allow them the freedom to do so, like they do with Chris Jericho, they do it with Jon Moxley, or the way that Impact does with the Good Brothers, who said, you know, once the pandemic lifts, their contracts allow them to book dates in New Japan if they want to go work there. That's a key selling point for some of these guys when they're deciding which company they want to sign with. WWE can probably pay you more than anybody else. I mean, not that Tony Khan doesn't have money, but you know, WWE is always able to just throw money at people, right? They did that with FTR and the Good Brothers. You know, they're going to pay these guys $650,000 or $750,000 a piece to keep them. Just to keep them from going somewhere else. But these other companies, one of the carrots that they've been able to dangle is if they have a working relationship with a company like a New Japan, or even if they don't, they can build clauses into their contracts and stipulations that allow them, as long as it doesn't conflict with, you know, their own dates. Sure, you're an independent contractor. Go ahead and book your own dates in Japan if you want to. WWE would never, you know, traditionally they would never allow something like that. So that's always been a selling point for these other companies that WWE, they could always do that if they wanted to, but it's just not how they operate. They've never operated that way. They would never allow that. It's like, no, you mean I could work for the biggest wrestling company in the world and still work dates now for New Japan? Like, if that would be a huge change if that were to happen. And that could shift the balance of power when it comes to, you know, what WWE is able to offer when it comes to some of these other promotions. All of a sudden, I can go work for WWE and actually go ahead and work dates in Japan too. And that could sway more people to sign with them. So I see it as being a smart move on their part if that's, let's say, how it all was to work out. Smart. It's smart for them to do that. I think the idea of WWE working with New Japan and having a talent exchange could be a cool thing. I think the idea of WWE working with New Japan as its exclusive American partner absolutely fucking sucks. And I hope it doesn't happen. Those are two distinctly different things. I am not against WWE having some form of a working relationship with New Japan. As long as New Japan keeps its eyes and ears open and pays very close attention, I wouldn't trust these people. Like I said, always an ulterior motive here. I would not necessarily trust their intentions. But them being the exclusive American partner for New Japan, I'm not a fan of that idea at all. And Tony Khan was poking fun at it. He recorded a video before Dynamite on Friday night. It was him and Tony Schiavone. And he said that he read in The Observer that WWE president Nick Khan was in talks with New Japan about a possible working relationship. He said Nick Khan had done a lot in the last 2 months. But he mentioned that in the last 2 weeks, New Japan talent like Ren Narita and Rocky Romero and Yuji Nagata had all appeared on AEW programming. He said he also had future plans with New Japan on what to do with the IWGP United States Championship, which Jon Moxley currently holds. He said there's only room for one con in pro wrestling, not some con man from Connecticut. And there's a lot of divided opinion about this. My first thought when I watched the video was how cringy it was. It was very cringe. But I also thought, whatever, he's having fun with it. You know, yeah, it's cringy. It's whatever. But it didn't bother me. I mean, it wasn't like some hugely embarrassing thing. He was poking fun at the story. It was tongue-in-cheek. So it didn't bother me the way it bothered other people. Mike Johnson of PW Insider chimed in on the Observer Report to inject a little bit of reality into things. I saw some people on Twitter talking about, oh, Okada is going to appear on Raw and wrestle R-Truth for the 24/7 title, and WWE is going to bury the New Japan guys. I mean, you talk about letting your imagination run wild. These people think that Okada and Tanahashi are going to be on SmackDown in 2 weeks. That's not how this is going to work, if this happens, I'm sure. But Johnson said there is and isn't something to the report. They were told by sources in both companies that there have been communications between the two sides for a few months now, but they have largely been centered around the possibility of Daniel Bryan being able to work some dates for New Japan. Bryan is not currently under contract to WWE. Although they are still talking about a potential new deal. But he has very publicly stated that he would love to work matches outside the company, and he's been trying to convince them to let him sign a deal that would allow him to do so. And right now, it sounds like that's really all there is to it. It sounds like that's really the extent of where things stand. WWE and New Japan are talking, but that's all it is. And it has nothing to do with there being any kind of wider working agreement. But look, if they work something out that allows Bryan to work some matches there, it's only natural to think that it could lead them to doing more business together in the future. But that sounds like it is still very far off. So all the New Japan fans can breathe easy for now. This is not the beginning of the end of New Japan, although the pandemic has really wreaked havoc on their business and on their roster. That's what worried me most about that initial report from Meltzer. I know COVID has had a big impact on them, and because of that, perhaps they would be more likely to want to do business with WWE. I don't want to say out of desperation, like they're about to go out of business, but you know, look, it's they've taken a hit. There's no doubt about it. They're at a low point right now in a lot of ways. Things are tough. They just lost their IWGP World Heavyweight Champion due to injury. 11 different talents were diagnosed recently with COVID that they were unable to use. Okada was one of them, but he's back now. He's doing better. Japan issued a COVID state of emergency in the country that was due to expire tomorrow. That has now been extended another 3 weeks through June 20th in Tokyo and a bunch of other areas. And that is going to severely limit the number of people they can have in the buildings, if they even run those places at all. I mean, there have been some New Japan shows in recent weeks that have done record low attendance. And not necessarily because the product is dead, but because they can't fit that many people in the building. So they've run venues in recent weeks where they've had 800 people, 600 people, because their hands are tied. You know, in Japan, their vaccine rollout has been non-existent. Only 5% of the country has been vaccinated in a country with 126 million people. They're hoping to have all of their elderly residents vaccinated by the end of July, which means that everyone else under the age of 65 won't even start getting the shots until late summer into the fall. And until that happens, they could see even more lockdowns and they can see more states of emergency extended. Every time that happens, it is a blow to the company. But they have announced a match between Okada and Shingo Takagi for the Dominion show on June 7th. It's on a Monday this time, not a Sunday, with the winner becoming the new IWGP World Heavyweight Champion. Either man would be a fine choice to hold that title. Shingo has never been champion before, but this feels like an Okada win to me. You know, when times are tough, what do? You put the belt back on the Rainmaker. You put it back on your biggest name. 1 week ago on this podcast, I said that Adnan Virk was terrible in the role of lead announcer on Raw. He had not gotten any better. He just didn't have the voice for it. Just didn't fit. Wasn't working out. And I said that I would be shocked if he was still employed there by the end of the year. 48 hours later, WWE and Virk announced that they had mutually agreed to part ways. He lasted all of 7 weeks on the job. Virk tweeted that the weekly travel along with his other jobs was a grind for him and his family. And while that may be true, this was less of a mutual decision and more of a WWE decision, recognizing what anyone with two ears could tell, which is that this was not working out. Per Fightful, WWE had made the call to get rid of him even before he worked the show last Monday. I knew he was doomed the moment that he did that podcast after he got the job, and he was already joking that, hey, if it doesn't work out, at least it would be a fun story for me to tell one day. That didn't inspire a lot of confidence when I heard that. He just wasn't lead announcer material in WWE. He was set up to fail from day one by putting him right in the hot seat as the lead announcer of their flagship show, 3 fucking hours every week, instead of putting him on a lesser show, a 1 hour show, a 2 hour show, in the lead spot, let him get his feet wet. They just threw him right into the fire and they set this guy up to fail. Now, his replacement has already been announced as Jimmy Smith, who has been an analyst for UFC and Bellator. Now, recently he has popped up on NXT pre-shows doing some stuff. He's been, you know, working closely with Michael Cole, and Michael Cole is supposedly very complimentary of him. But he's an MMA guy. He's an MMA guy who, by his own admission in a tweet he posted a couple of years ago, had not watched pro wrestling since he was in grade school. When Jimmy Smith was in grade school, Vince McMahon was hosting the first WrestleMania. Hulk Hogan was the champion. That's how long it's been since Jimmy Smith was a pro wrestling fan and was watching it with any sort of regularity. He starts tomorrow night with Corey Graves and Byron Saxton. He has never done play-by-play before. So we now have three color commentators on Monday Night Raw. And to put a nice bow on things, Tom Phillips, who was replaced by Virk the night after WrestleMania, was released this week. On April 12th, WWE put a press release out about Virk joining the Raw announce team and said that Phillips would become the new host of 205 Live and would oversee special projects for their programming on Peacock and would stay on as senior manager for on-air talent. And they also said that Samoa Joe remained with the company as part of its talent roster. This was after they took him off commentary. And it is just amazing how much can change in just a few weeks. So they replaced their longtime play-by-play guy who had been with the company for, I think, a decade or almost a decade, and has worked on Raw, has worked on SmackDown, has worked on NXT, with someone who has never called a wrestling match a day in his life. And then they replaced that guy with someone who not only has never called a wrestling match before, he hasn't even watched wrestling since he was a kid. He doesn't even do play-by-play. And then they fire the actual play-by-play guy that they previously demoted. These people have their heads so far up their asses they can smell their own farts before they even leave their anal cavity. I don't know what they're thinking. Pat McAfee, at least, has taken nicely to the role of color man on SmackDown. I think he does a good job. But the announced situation in WWE has never been in crisis mode more than it is today. It's like, you know, theme music. When Jim Johnston was talking to Chris Van Vliet, and they had that great interview a few weeks ago, they talked about the importance of theme music, which is so true. The announcing plays such an important role in the show, just like theme music does. It adds so much, or it can. And there has been so much turnover with the announcers that, you know, look, I hope Jimmy Smith ends up taking to the role the way Pat McAfee has. You know, he's got an outgoing personality. He's got some charisma. Maybe he'll end up doing a bang-up job. Maybe he'll prove a lot of people wrong. But there has been so much turnover and just so many changes made. One guy is in and then he's out, and then another guy is in and he's out. And some of the announcers, they do an okay job, and some of the announcing is just fucking horrendous. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're produced a certain way, or they have Vince McMahon in their ear, so maybe in another environment they'd be even better as an announcer. Maybe we don't get to see that, because that's just not the way that WWE does things. But the announcing situation in this company has never been in more of a state of crisis than it is today. Hopefully this guy will last longer than 7 weeks. It would be embarrassing for the company if they were to get rid of him so soon after getting rid of Virk. So he'll last longer than 7 weeks. Even if he has a falling out with Vince McMahon, he'll last longer than Virk did. The question is, how much longer? We should all start taking bets. Let's all start taking bets. How much longer, I think, is going to depend on how he reacts to Vince McMahon yelling in his ear every week. Raw this week, yet again, according to PW Insider, there was a lot of ripping up of the script all day before they went live on USA. A lot of the first hour of the show on Monday wasn't even finalized until 30 minutes before the show. It's like Nitro all over again. But we ended up with a good match between Drew McIntyre and Kofi Kingston in that first hour to decide who would challenge Bob Lashley for the WWE Championship at Hell in a Cell. Kofi had pointed out in the opening promo correctly that McIntyre is fed rematch after rematch after rematch. He told him to step his ass aside because he never got his rematch for the WWE title after being beaten by Brock Lesnar. And they were having a good match until Lashley attacked McIntyre while MVP attacked Kofi, so we got no winner. Adam Pearce announced a rematch for tomorrow night between McIntyre and Kingston, with the winner going to Hell in a Cell. And this time, if Lashley or MVP interfere, Lashley is suspended for 90 days without pay. The outcome will be the same as I predicted. Drew McIntyre is going to Hell in a Cell, I believe, to challenge for the WWE Championship one more time. I don't see them going, back-to-back months of triple threat matches on pay-per-view for that title. It was a good night for the New Day in the ring. Kofi had a real good match with Drew, but Xavier Woods and Matt Riddle stole the show in their match. I thought their match was fucking great. I loved the spot where they had their hands clasped together. Riddle was on his back, and Woods pulled him up in one motion into a vertical suplex position. Riddle hit a deadlift German from the middle rope with one of the worst landings I've ever seen on a German suplex. Woods landed right on top of his head. I liked Riddle getting frustrated and hitting an RKO for the win at the end. After the match, he looked into the camera and said, "That one's for you, Randy." And on Twitter, Orton's reaction was, "Nice form, but don't steal my shit." This was the best Xavier Woods singles match I've seen him have in WWE. You know, he wants to be King of the Ring. If they ever do another King of the Ring tournament, I don't know about winning it, but he absolutely deserves to be in it. And maybe go all the way to the finals before falling short. But this was great stuff. Nikki Cross reemerged from her hibernation. She appeared on Raw telling Charlotte and Rhea Ripley in the back that she could beat either of them. And Charlotte said that she could beat her in 2 minutes, but she already had a match scheduled with Asuka again. So Rhea took her up on the offer instead, and they proceeded to do the beat-the-clock deal, which I hate. Rhea was kicking the shit out of her in the corner as time ran out, and Nikki ran around the ring celebrating like she had just won the women's title. She looked like a complete goof. And Rhea just shrugged her shoulders and smiled like, "Well, you got me." I thought they were each going to flash a thumbs up at one another like one of those cheesy Mentos commercials from the 90s. What did Nikki Cross win here? Tell me, what did she win? Nothing. She won nothing. But hey, at least she got TV time, right? I forgot she was even employed with the company. That's how long it's been since I've seen her on the show. And now, class is in session with Professor Solomonster. Everybody get your books. Take a seat. Here is this week's problem-solving exercise. You know, when I was in school, the teacher called it the do now. I don't know if they do that in other schools and other parts of the country, but when I was in middle school, it was you always had a do now exercise that you would do right at the very beginning of class. This is your do now. 2 weeks ago, Asuka pinned Charlotte. This week, Charlotte pinned Asuka. If Asuka pinned Charlotte, and then Charlotte pinned Asuka, which one of them gets to challenge Rhea Ripley for the Raw Women's title at Hell in a Cell? If you answered Charlotte, congratulations. You deserve a spot on the Raw writing team. Charlotte Flair will indeed be the one to challenge for the championship after her win on Monday night. I guess it's like each character having a score in a video game. Right? Charlotte has more points than Asuka does, therefore her win means more. Or something, I guess. Who the fuck knows? Jackson Ryker got a pinfall win over AJ Styles. Those words should never be spoken. Elias caught Styles with a knee strike when the referee wasn't looking, and Ryker hit a black hole slam for the win. Omos lumbered down to the ring to go after Elias, who ran off with Ryker before Omos caught up with him and body-checked Elias into the LED boards. Just awful. Just awful. There still has been no turn by AJ or Omos, so I guess they're just supposed to be the babyfaces by default in this feud. I just can't bring myself to care about any of this. They actually headlined this show with the women's tag team titles on the line. Natty and Tamina defending against Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler. Nia Jax in the Raw main event. Nia Jax and Reginald, I should say, in the Raw main event. Reginald was trying to help, but he ended up distracting the referee while Baszler had Natty pinned with a small package. Shayna ordered him to leave, and as he is walking up the ramp to go to the back, flames shoot up into the air, and he sells this like he has been blinded, just like the week before. And Natty wins with the old distraction roll-up finish to retain the tag team titles. Shayna goes outside. She helps Reginald up to his feet, grabs him by the jacket, and calls him a son of a bitch, and said that this Monday they're going to have a match. And she's going to make him wish that he was in that fire. Funny enough, that's the way I feel most weeks by the end of watching this show. This would be terrible by normal standards, but as your main event of this 3-hour show, I mean, that's about as bad as it gets. What more is there to say? SmackDown, a little bit of a palate cleanser here. SmackDown was highlighted by a hot opening tag team match between the Usos and the Street Profits. Unless you're running the WWE on Fox YouTube page, in which case it was the Usos against the SmackDown Tag Team Champions, The New Day. Xavier Woods had fun pointing that out on Twitter. I guess to WWE on Fox, they all look the same. I'm surprised they didn't call them Crime Time. Not only that, the Street Profits aren't even the champions, so everything about that title in that video was a fucking fail. But the match was great. The Usos pulled out the win, and now they'll challenge for the tag team titles this Friday night. I mean, they're just rushing right into it. But I do not expect them to leave with those titles. More on that in a second. The Riot Squad got some time in the ring with the women's tag champs, fell short with Tamina pinning Ruby Riot after the Superfly Splash. Bianca Belair beat Carmella in a match with Bayley sitting next to Michael Cole providing commentary. She was a riot. Not a Ruby Riot, but she was a riot. The best part was the finish, where Bianca hit her Kiss of Death finish, and Cole called her Belanca. Boy, you know, Michael Cole has a thing for fucking up Bianca Belair match finishes, doesn't he? First WrestleMania, now this. Bayley just jumped on him for it right away, called him a stupid idiot. Bayley is fantastic. Seth Rollins cut a promo in the ring in one of his ridiculous suits. He demanded that Cesaro come down to the ring before he started laughing, and he remembered that Cesaro wasn't there after the beating he laid down on him the week before. It was his birthday, so he was happy that Cesaro wasn't there to ruin it. This went on and on and on and included supposed exclusive audio from Cesaro's hospital room of him moaning in pain. The only one moaning in pain was me sitting through this segment. Had I known that it was his birthday, I would have bought him a defective microphone. It would have made this a lot smoother. Kevin Owens had Apollo Crews beat with a stunner in a short match before Aziz reached in and hit Owens with the Nigerian nail for the DQ. Adam Pearce later granted Owens a rematch this Friday for the championship with Aziz barred from ringside, so that's two title matches now scheduled for this week. The main event was to be Rey and Dominic Mysterio defending their SmackDown tag team titles in a rematch against Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode. Rey was attacked in the back before the match while he was kneeling and praying. So the same way Dominic got beaten up in the back before their match at Backlash, although I don't know if he was praying or what he was doing. Dominic went to the ring by himself to do the match one-on-two. He worked pretty much the entire match by himself until the finish when Rey's music hit. He walked out. This distracted Dolph Ziggler, and Dominic got a victory roll pin on Bobby Roode to retain the titles. Usos came out to confront the champions as the show went off the air, with them cutting to a shot of Roman Reigns in the back, watching on with a very displeased look on his face. Earlier in the show, he met with Jey Uso in the back. And, you know, Jey's his right-hand man, right? Main event Jey Uso. And he made Jey question whether he really wants to go for the tag team titles with his brother this week. You know, with his brother, he said he's back to opening matches instead of being in main events, and people asking the question, which one are you? And Jay said, you know, I never looked at it that way. And Roman told him, well, maybe you should. I love the way that Reigns is planting a wedge between the two brothers. It's why I think the match at Hell in a Cell has got to be Roman defending against Jimmy Uso. And why they're not going to win the tag team titles this Friday. It's too soon. You don't rush into that. It's too soon for that. The opening match and the Reigns stuff is really all you need to see. I thought Bayley was entertaining as usual. No follow-up to Aleister Black attacking Big E the week before. They apparently left them off the show on purpose, according to PW Insider, with the idea that there's no need to rush things. Let a week go by, focus on other stories, and then come back to it next week. Nothing wrong with that. NXT on Tuesday had Shotzi Blackheart and Ember Moon picking up a win over Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez. Kai took the losing fall. If this becomes a recurring theme, I could see Gonzalez growing sick of carrying her around, so that's something to keep an eye on. She laid a pretty vicious beatdown, did the champ, on Shotzi after the match was over while Dakota made Ember watch. So they seem to be setting up singles title matches, potentially, for both Ember and Shotzi against Raquel. Bobby Fish lost his first match back to Pete Dunne and then had his surgically repaired arm attacked by Oney Lorcan after the match was over. Very strange that they went with the Dunne match first instead of giving Fish a win over Lorcan and then building to a match with Dunne. Dunne's the one who injured him at War Games, but you got to get through Lorcan to get to Pete Dunne. Like, that's how I would have expected it to go. And they did not do that. We had a million-dollar face-off in the ring with Cameron Grimes and Ted DiBiase. When I hear that Million Dollar Man theme music, I cannot help but sing along. Which I will not do right now, but I assure you, when I was watching it, I was singing along. Grimes just wanted to know why. Why? Why are you making my life a living hell? What have I ever done to you? DiBiase said, look, I like you, kid, but ever since you came into all this money, you've lost focus. And as he's talking, we hear the music, and out comes L.A. Knight. Got into the ring, and Grimes didn't want him in the ring. He said this was between two millionaires, not a nickel and dimer. And Knight dropped him with his cutter. This segment seemed designed to turn Cameron Grimes babyface, start a program with him and L.A. Knight, who did walk out with Ted DiBiase. DiBiase was following Knight as Knight walked to the back. And I, you know, if this were 25 years ago, I think Knight would have made a perfect million-dollar man protege, million-dollar champion with DiBiase as his manager. As it is now, it's nice to see DiBiase here and there, but he can barely walk. I know he's had both of his knees replaced years ago. He can barely move around. I don't see him as a new manager for somebody. And LA Knight does not need a manager. If you were going to put Ted DiBiase with somebody on this roster, LA Knight is the last person who needs a mouthpiece. He does not need anybody to do the talking for him. He's a great talker by himself. I'm not saying like great talkers can't have managers, but I don't see there being this great need to put Ted DiBiase with someone like Eli Drake. Now, if the idea is to reintroduce the million-dollar title and have Grimes and Knight fight for it, and maybe Knight wins it, walks around with it, but isn't necessarily managed by DiBiase, that I think could work. I know it didn't work out too well for Ted Jr., but I do think in NXT they can make that work. But that entire segment, when it was over, it just seemed to me it was designed, like the singular purpose of that segment was to begin the babyface turn for Cameron Grimes. By the way, you know, while we're talking about the Million Dollar Man here, the Million Dollar Man was tweeting about something, and it's on his website. If you go to milliondollarman.com, they are doing, I don't know if it's a petition or what this is supposed to be, but this is what it says on his website, and then there's a form that you fill out with your personal information. It says, in February of 1988, Ted DiBiase enlisted the enlisted the services of the legendary Andre the Giant to assist with capturing the WWF Championship. Andre was successful in pinning Hulk Hogan at the Market Square Arena in Indianapolis, Indiana. In the history books, WWE has decided not to recognize this title reign, even though Ted defended the title at a live show against Bam Bam Bigelow. Support Ted by signing this petition asking WWE to hashtag make it official. And I guess they're trying to start a social media campaign with that hashtag, hashtag make it official. I don't know where this came from. I don't know why this is an issue all of a sudden. WWE has never acknowledged DiBiase as being the champion before, even though he did defend the title at a couple of house shows, which apparently didn't do very well. I don't think those house shows drew very well. But, yeah, so I don't know where this came from, but what's interesting to me is that you have to fill out a form. It's not just using the hashtag. They have a form on his webpage. You put your name and email address in there. They want your email address. So I'm not signing up for that shit. But it seems to me like they want people's emails for something. What that is, I don't know. But I don't know. Just very bizarre. All of a sudden, this is a campaign, I guess, that somebody said to DiBiase, hey, we got a great idea, Ted. You should petition to have your name put in the record books. Although I'd love to see this record book. I still haven't seen a copy of this official WWE record book. But DiBiase recognizes the champion. Yeah, you know, in storyline, he didn't win it. He bought it. Remember Jack Tunney said you can't buy the championship, so therefore it doesn't count. But there's been other people who have been crowned champion or awarded the title for bullshit reasons. So you know what? If they wanted to put DiBiase in the record books as champion for a week or 2 weeks or whatever it was, or a few days, you know what? Go ahead and do it. May as well. I've seen people far less worthy be handed championships for nothing, so why not? He looked good with that belt around his waist, I'll say that. That winged eagle belt. Frankie Monet made her in-ring debut with a win over Cora Jade, exactly the kind of dominant win you should give somebody in their first match. We did not see much, but she won with the Glam Slam, which Beth Phoenix at ringside was quick to point out is her move. I thought this was effective for what it was designed to be. It seemed maybe they're planting a little seedling for the future with Monet and Beth Phoenix. The new North American champion, Bronson Reed, was in a suit for a promo. Said it took him 14 years to get to this moment. It took all of 14 seconds for him to be interrupted by Legado del Fantasma. At long last, Santos Escobar has broken away from the cruiserweight division. All three were ready to attack when MSK ran out to even the odds, and MSK will defend their NXT tag team titles against Mendoza and Joaquin Wilde this Tuesday. Probably, I'm assuming we'll have Reed defending his title at In Your House against Escobar. Speaking of In Your House, William Regal announced a triple threat match for this Tuesday with the winner challenging for the NXT Championship at TakeOver In Your House. This Tuesday, it's going to be Kyle O'Reilly against Pete Dunne against Johnny Gargano. The Kyle O'Reilly babyface turn has been very underwhelming. I do not see him as NXT champion material. I see him one day. I said this years ago about Kyle O'Reilly, and I feel the same way now that I did 3 or 4 years ago when I made this comment. I see him one day as being a great intercontinental champion, like on SmackDown, especially with some of the names they have on SmackDown. He could have some really good matches on that show. That's where I see Kyle O'Reilly. But unless he were to catch fire organically the way that, you know, Daniel Bryan did years ago and the fans command that you must push Kyle O'Reilly, I just don't see him at that level. I just don't see him rising to that level. And he's already challenged enough times for the NXT title. We don't need to see it again. It's going to be Pete Dunne or Johnny Gargano. Gargano could be a heel for Cross to just beat. So could Dunn, but they're clearly grooming Pete Dunn for something bigger. But because I think, you know, we may be getting O'Reilly against Dunn at TakeOver, I'm going to say Johnny Gargano grabs the win coming off his loss to Bronson Reed, and he challenges, you know, Karrion Kross for the championship. Karrion Kross did retain his NXT title against Finn Balor. I thought it was a good main event, not great. It was good. They gave them a lot of time. Kross put Balor out with a sleeper, so they put him over strongly with that finish. I'm still waiting on Karrion Kross to have that one really great NXT match that I can point to. He's had some good ones, but none that kind of rise to the level of a match I think you're going to remember at the end of the year when the year is over. Balor has had a much longer run on NXT than I ever thought he would. I know there's not a lot of reason to have faith in these main roster call-ups, but we talk about how they need to freshen things up on Raw and they need to freshen things up on SmackDown. To do that, you need new faces. And Balor would be, he's been gone long enough that Balor would be a new face. He's been gone for so long, and I would prefer to see him on SmackDown. Raw could definitely use him. WrestleVotes this week tweeted that the Raw creative team have asked for Balor now for months. The NXT crew adores him. They don't want to see him go, but it's time. It's time for him to move on. By the way, the fact that the Raw creative team wants Finn Balor means absolutely nothing. The Raw creative team could want chocolate chip cookies. If Vince McMahon wants oatmeal raisin, then oatmeal raisin is what they're going to get. They could have all the ideas in the world on what to do with Finn Balor, but it's Vince McMahon's call to make, and that's kind of what worries me. But I think it's a risk that you take, because Raw or SmackDown could really use someone like him on their roster right now. Especially, you know, I hate to say it, but Raw, they are in dire need of babyfaces. So of the two brands, the one that probably needs him more is Monday Night Raw.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we go back 37 years ago this week. On May 24th, 1984, Vincent J. McMahon, father of the currently living Vince McMahon and the man who, back in 1963, founded what is today WWE, passed away at the age of 69 from pancreatic cancer. He always maintained very friendly relations with other promoters. He sold WWE to his son in 1982. I don't know if that was before or after he was diagnosed with cancer, but he lived another 2 years after that, not long enough to see the first WrestleMania and to see his son expand the operation nationally. Vince Jr. told Sports Illustrated in 1991, "Had my father known what I was going to do, he never would have sold his stock to me." 36 years ago this week, on May 24th, 1985, WWE hosted a show at the UIC Pavilion in Chicago. And on the show that night, doing guest commentary for some of the matches and doing some of the backstage interviews with some of the talent, was Oprah Winfrey. Yes, Oprah did commentary for WWE and nearly lasted as long in the role as Adnan Virk did on Raw. She joined Jerry Valiant, former wrestler Jerry Valiant, on headset for the final three matches of the evening. Those three matches aired on her AM Chicago show 3 days later, a show that she took from last in the ratings to first, even beating Phil Donahue in the Chicago market, which is what led to movie critic Roger Ebert suggesting, he kind of prodded her, that she should go ahead and sign a syndication deal, which is what she did. And the rest is history. Now, two funny things from the video when I watched it again on YouTube the other day, both involving Hulk Hogan and Oprah. First, in her backstage interview with Hogan before his match with Don Morocco, she asked him at one point if he did any drugs, which is funny enough. I mean, they were all doing drugs back then. I'm sure Hogan was hardly the only one. I mean, it was the 80s. But she was asking him, you know, because you're a role model to children all over the country, and it's very important to let them know that it's not just that you tell them not to do these things, but they have to know that you don't actually do these things. You know, drugs are bad, okay? Hogan says that the drugs, all that drug stuff, went out a long time ago. Drugs, apparently drugs, went out a long time ago, according to the Hulkster. He said they went out with Woodstock in 69. There hasn't been a drug since. He goes, "There's no drugs in my life." So that was funny. At the end of the show, after his big win, he's in the ring, he's posing, he's celebrating, and Oprah steps into the ring to celebrate with him. and she tries to get his attention. She's like reaching to grab him by the arm to like raise his arm. He turns around. He obviously had no idea that she was, you know, planning on coming into the ring. He turns around and he sees her. So now he is staring at Oprah. And she's grabbing his arm and he just completely blows her off. And just leaves the ring as quickly as possible and goes right back to the dressing room. Does not even acknowledge her. So now she's left in the ring all by herself. But she's happy, you know, she's just happy to be there. And in watching it, I honestly believe he did not realize that it was the same woman who had interviewed him earlier in the night. And he probably thought that she was just a random fan that got into the ring. So he got the hell out of there. I'll bet anything that that's exactly what happened. Just you watch it, it's just very bizarre. 34 years ago this week, on May 26th, 1987, before Rob Van Dam and Sabu got pulled over by the cops in 2006, which killed RVD's run as the WWE champion, there was Hacksaw Jim Duggan and the Iron Sheik, who were arrested by New Jersey State Police during a routine traffic stop. They were pulled over on the Garden State Parkway by a trooper who said that he saw Duggan, who I assume was in the driver's seat, drinking beer. And Duggan was charged with possession of less than 25 grams of marijuana and having an open alcohol container in the car, while Sheiky Baby was charged with cocaine possession. 3 grams worth, to be exact, as well as possession of less than 25 grams of marijuana. The incident made national news because they had been feuding on WWE television at the time. And this was an era where, you know, kayfabe was still protected. And for the two of them to be riding together, I mean, that plus the drugs, it was a PR nightmare for WWE. Both men were fired over the incident. Eventually, though, they were brought back, although Sheik didn't come back for many years. When he finally did, he was General Adnan. Duggan was brought back a lot sooner. Later that year, he was already back. But, you know, it was tough for Duggan. It was a huge blow for him. He had just debuted for the company a few months before this, and one of his first appearances was at WrestleMania 3. You know, he wasn't in a match, but he was on the show and took a 2x4 to the Iron Sheik's back. Even after they brought him back to the company, he felt they never pushed him at a high level again because of that incident. He felt it killed all of his momentum. Even though he did win the first televised Royal Rumble match less than a year later. In his book, Duggan said that he never regained the momentum that he had before the arrest. They only used him as a mid-card guy when he believes he would have eventually been either WWE champion, Intercontinental champion, maybe a tag team champion. It sounds ridiculous, the idea of him being WWE champion, even though he was over. I mean, he was one of the more over babyfaces in the company. But it sounds ridiculous that in the era of Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage, that they would put the title on Jim Duggan. But here's why I would not completely laugh it off. He was a huge star in Mid-South before he came to WWE. And again, this happened not long after he debuted. He had already been headlining some house shows in matches against Andre the Giant, and they wouldn't just put anybody in that spot. You know, headlining against Andre, winning matches against Andre. So for a while there, they trusted him in that top babyface position to headline those shows that Hogan, you know, wasn't on. Had that push continued, who's to say that when Hogan leaves the following year to go make No Holds Barred and they need somebody to step in and put that belt on, that Duggan would not have been that guy? Or that Duggan would, you know, maybe Duggan would have been the guy to feud with, let's say, Ted DiBiase through much of 88. If DiBiase had won the championship at WrestleMania 4, you know, Duggan and DiBiase had a very memorable feud in Mid-South. They worked together plenty of times before. If you believe the you know, legend that they only went with Savage because Honky Tonk Man refused to drop the Intercontinental title to him the month before WrestleMania, then Savage would have been the Intercontinental Champion. He would not have been wrestling for the WWF title. So the idea of Duggan either being the champion or being the number one contender to feud with a heel like DiBiase really is not as far-fetched as it seems. 25 years ago this week, first, on May 26th, 1996, WWE presented its In Your House Beware of Dog pay-per-view from Florence, South Carolina. This was the night of the big power outage that knocked down most of the show for viewers at home. The Smoking Guns won the tag team titles from the Godwins on the free-for-all pre-show. And in the opening match of the pay-per-view, Wildman Mark Mero beat Hunter Hearst Helmsley. After which, a massive thunderstorm in the area knocked out the power and the pay-per-view feed right before the start of the Caribbean strap match between Stone Cold Steve Austin and Savio Vega. I vividly remember sitting there watching a blue screen for an hour until the feed finally came back on just in time for the main event, which is all they had time for. Remember, these In Your House shows were not very long. They were only about 2 hours, actually a little less than 2 hours. But it came back on just in time for the main event between Shawn Michaels and the British Bulldog for the WWE title. This was not one of their better matches, and they did a disputed finish with Michaels hitting a German suplex. There had been a ref bump prior to this, and for the finish, we had two different referees counting each of their shoulders, so each referee had a different view. One was looking at Shawn Michaels' shoulders down on the mat. The other was looking at Davey Boy Smith's shoulders on the mat. They both counted three. Controversy ensued. One said Shawn Michaels won. The other said Bulldog won. Gorilla Monsoon had to come out to help litigate. So it ended in a no contest. Michaels was livid. First at a fan in the crowd that was heckling him at one point when Bulldog had him in a rest hold. Michaels looked over and cussed the fan out, called her a fat cow, which only caused other fans in her section to turn on him. And he was also pissed at the fact that he and Bulldog both had no idea that this match was airing live on TV. They thought they were still off the air and that they would just get to do the match over again a couple days later on the replay, you know, with all the other matches that didn't air. So they were just sort of going through the motions and doing a lot of rest holds. About midway through the match, Earl Hebner relays to them that, hey, in fact, you guys are on the air and there would be no rematch on Tuesday. So here's the finish that you need to do. And by that point, they both felt that the match couldn't be saved. They were both just infuriated. Michaels threw a temper tantrum. I mean, a big surprise there. Not the first time he would do that in a pay-per-view match in 96. But he threw a temper tantrum in the ring after the match was over that got edited off all of the subsequent viewings. So unless you were watching the show live, I doubt that you can probably find any footage of it. Certainly not on the network. But while the power was out, the matches in the arena went on as planned. They used the battery-operated cameras to film. They had a low-power generator, and the matches continued. The show must go on! And so Savio Vega defeated Steve Austin, Yokozuna defeated Vader, and Goldust beat The Undertaker in a casket match to retain his Intercontinental title. But the video quality was so poor, they couldn't use the footage. They were the literal definition of dark matches. So instead, they used the Tuesday replay of the show on pay-per-view to run back the three matches that didn't air. They basically ran a Beware of Dog Part 2 two nights later in North Charleston, South Carolina, at what doubled as a Superstars taping. This was supposed to be a Superstars taping. It ended up being a partial pay-per-view as well. Vega again defeated Steve Austin in a strap match. Only this time, Ted DiBiase, who was managing Austin at the time, had added the stipulation that if his man did not win, he, being DiBiase, would leave the World Wrestling Federation. This was his send-off as he was headed to WCW a few months later. The strap match, by the way, between these two, obviously I never saw the first one. Nobody did unless you were in the building that night. But the strap match at Beware of Dog 2, really, really good. It's actually one of my favorite Steve Austin matches. So if you can track that down, well, it's probably on Peacock. Definitely give that a watch. Vader beat Yokozuna. That was the only match outcome that had changed from two nights earlier. They just basically flip-flopped the winner in that match. And Goldust beat The Undertaker in a casket match for the Intercontinental title when Mankind popped out of the casket, put the mandible claw on The Undertaker, and put him in the casket. Now, the Superstars taping that night was pretty noteworthy. Featured Triple H giving Marty Garner the scariest-looking pedigree that I have ever seen. It looked like Garner's, it might have been his fault, like he thought, you know, Triple H was going for a suplex or something. He somehow ended upside down and got spiked right down on top of his head. It is a miracle he did not break his neck and wind up in a wheelchair. And Steve Austin beat Jason Arndt in a squash using the Stone Cold Stunner for the very first time on TV. And Arndt would go on years later to become part of Shane McMahon's Mean Street Posse as Joey Abs. This was an important night in the evolution of Steve Austin, if you think about it. First, he lost DiBiase as his mouthpiece, which he never really needed in the first place. And he debuted one of the most famous finishing moves in wrestling history. In between these two dates, in between 26 and 28, comes 27, as in May 27, 1996, WCW aired its first ever two-hour edition of Monday Nitro from Macon, Georgia, remembered for the first appearance of Scott Hall coming out of the crowd during a very exciting barn burner of a match between the legendary Steve Dahl and the Mauler, who used to be Blake of the Beverly Brothers in WWE. This was the start of one of the biggest angles in wrestling history. This was the genesis of what would become the New World Order. Hall was basically playing the Razor Ramon character. Only difference is he was wearing denim. And right down to the accent, this was Razor Ramon. He said, "You people know who I am, but you don't know why I'm here. You want to go to war? You want a war? You're going to get one." Forget CM Punk. This right here, especially if you were a fan back then and you remember watching this, this right here, this was the real pipe bomb that set things off. He came back out for another promo at the end of the show to confront Eric Bischoff at the announce desk, or as he called him, the Ken Doll announcer, challenging him to get three of his best guys to take on three of their own. Again, acting like he was there on behalf of Vince McMahon. It's just like Vince McMahon sent him. The idea was to set up a six-man tag at the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view in July with Hall, Nash, who would debut a couple weeks later, and Lex Luger, very likely being the one to turn against WCW. The idea was that, you know, in storyline, the idea would be that from the moment Luger came back to WCW the previous year, he was basically a mole for WWE. And they would then take on Sting, who was also talked about for that third spot, and I think Eric Bischoff said the idea would have been to go with Sting. So again, Luger may have been one of the initial working ideas. But they would have taken on Sting, Randy Savage, and either Ric Flair or The Giant. This was before Bischoff ultimately got Hulk Hogan to agree to turn heel, which worked out far better than Lex Luger would have, or Sting. You know, for this to work as well as it did, it really had to be Hogan. This does not work as well as it does if you don't get the biggest star in the company, who at one time was the biggest star in the other company, to be that third man. It just, you know, it might work for a while, but it definitely does not rise to the level that the NWO ends up rising to. Vince McMahon had to go on Raw the following Monday and state that Diesel and Razor Ramon were no longer part of the World Wrestling Federation and that they were participating in a ruse for a rival wrestling organization. They also released a copy of a legal letter that they had sent to Scott Hall. They put this letter out on their America Online site for everybody to read, which basically let Hall know that he was infringing on their intellectual property by continuing to portray the Razor Ramon character and utilize the Hispanic accent that they had given to him. And as such, they would be withholding all future payments that were due to him until the matter is resolved. 24 years ago this week, on the May 26, 1997 episode of Monday Night Raw, one of the greatest matches in Raw history took place with Stone Cold Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels as unlikely partners, beating Owen Hart and the British Bulldog to win the Tag Team Championship. One of my favorite Raw matches. Michaels was just on absolute fire in this match. He was moving around with lightning speed. You watch this match, you would not think twice about calling Shawn Michaels the best in the world at that point, or at least the best in this country. This was in the ring, this was peak Shawn Michaels right here. And it was his first match in 3 months. This is his very first time back in the ring since he lost his smile. And he was on Raw crying and teasing that he might have a career-ending knee injury. 90 days later, he's back in the ring. No signs of ring rust, no signs of injury, no signs of slowing down. He was as good as ever. It was amazing. Didn't miss a beat. Austin left Michaels to die in the ring at the hands of the Hart Foundation when the match was over. They were beating down Shawn Michaels. Austin, while his partner was getting the shit kicked out of him, he went and grabbed the belts. He started making his way around the ring. He's looking inside. He's kind of thinking, should I get in there and help him? And then Austin looks over and he sees Bret Hart all by himself. The Hart Foundation left him all alone up there. He's standing up, but this was during the period where Bret was still getting over the knee surgery that he had. He was in the wheelchair. He's standing there with one good leg. Austin locks eyes with him. Bret sees him, says, oh shit. And Austin takes off for Bret, runs up the ramp, tackles him down. A very memorable segment, very memorable angle on Raw. Wheelchair Bret, one of the better incarnations of Bret, because it forced him to cut more promos. And I still say 97 was really his best promo year. Outside of that one El Dandy promo he did with Mean Gene in WCW. 22 years ago this week on May 24th, 1999. 3 years after, or 2 years. 2 years after being part of what I just talked about, one of the greatest matches in Raw history. WWE aired a special episode of Raw is War as a tribute to the late Owen Hart, who died the night before at their Over the Edge pay-per-view. They opened with a 10-bell salute. They aired several testimonials from talent throughout the night. The show ended with Stone Cold Steve Austin, one night removed from losing his title to The Undertaker, marching down to the ring in his camo gear to do a toast on behalf of the entire company, the whole roster. He was kind of the face that they sent down there to do the toasting at the very end in the middle of the ring. Austin was not shy before this about not being a fan of Owen after the botch pile driver that almost paralyzed him at SummerSlam. I know there was a Rolling Stone interview about 6 months before this where it was pretty clear that he still had not forgiven Owen for what happened. But on this night, this was about paying tribute to a fallen colleague. Not that television ratings were the most important thing on this night, but the show did a 7.2 Nielsen rating, which I believe is the second highest overall number in the history of Monday Night Raw, second only to the 8.1 that they did a few weeks before this when Nitro was preempted by the NBA. Between Raw and Nitro on this night, more people were tuned into pro wrestling in one night than any other time since the days of Saturday night's main event. 12 years ago this week, on May 25th, 2009, Monday Night Raw aired live from the Staples Center in Los Angeles after being booted from the Pepsi Center in Denver with only 8 days' notice due to an NBA playoff game between the Nuggets and the Lakers that took priority. WWE booked the venue the previous August, claimed that nobody from the arena contacted them until about a week prior about the cancellation. Although they did try to help WWE move the event to the smaller Denver Coliseum, which seats about 10,000 people. Problem is, WWE had around 10,000 tickets sold for this event. And so maybe they could have squeezed everybody into that building, but they would not have been able to get anybody else in there. They wouldn't have been able to get their giant Raw set. You know how they love their big gaudy sets. Vince McMahon lost his mind. And, you know, I'm sure he also saw this as a PR opportunity, but he lost his mind, went on the offensive. Usually when he does this and he starts making the media rounds, he looks terrible. This was no exception. He was all over the media for an entire week, bashing Stan Kroenke, the owner of the Nuggets and the owner of the Pepsi Center, which is now called the Ball Arena. I guess that's its new name. He went on ESPN News to be interviewed by former WWE announcer Jonathan Coachman, who he never acknowledged. Coachman was, you know, good to see you. Good to see you, sir. And he was, you know, kind of, you know, being all folksy with him and everything. And Vince was just, it was so awkward. You would think that Coach was just a total stranger and Vince McMahon didn't even know who this guy was. Like he never met him before. But McMahon said that it was his view. This is how he started the interview. He said it was his view that Stan Kroenke should be arrested for impersonating a good businessman. If he tried to tell jokes like this in a stand-up comedy club, people would throw fucking tomatoes at him. A good businessman, he said, does not book a World Wrestling Federation live event on a Monday night, figuring that his team isn't going to make the playoffs. And yes, I did not make a mistake there. He said World Wrestling Federation. He misstated the name of his own company 7 years after the name change. He joked about challenging Kroenke to a cage match, and then he held up a Lakers jersey at the end of the segment. This is like a wrestling promo. The whole week, he was bashing Kroenke. The whole week that he was bashing this guy, WWE was negotiating with Kroenke's company on some sort of resolution that would have seen them move the show to the Denver Coliseum anyway. And the Kroenke folks, it was far enough along that they thought that they had reached a verbal agreement. And they even went as far as to draft a press release that was going to go out. All they had to do was click send. They were just waiting on approval from Vince and WWE, only for WWE to then go behind their back and make a deal with the Staples Center in the rival city of Los Angeles. And Vince McMahon later said that the deal breaker was the quote that Kroenke's people had drafted that would be attributed to him that was going to be in the press release. And that quote would have read as follows. This is what Kroenke's people drafted that they were hoping Vince would approve. I would like to thank Stan Kroenke and his management team for resolving this matter so quickly in a way that allows all WWE and Nuggets fans to watch two world-class main events Sunday and Monday, because they had two shows scheduled. By all accounts, Mr. Kroenke is one of the most respected professional sports teams owners in the world, and the professional way that he and his staff good-naturedly handled this conflict gives further testament to the type of business leader that he is. We look forward to Sunday's WWE event and future events at the Pepsi Center. McMahon told the Associated Press, "They would not even talk about making a deal other than paying our expenses, basically unless we signed some sort of joint press release. You would not believe what these people were attempting to make us do. I guess maybe running over us and throwing us out unceremoniously on our ear was not good enough. They want to trample us." And then he was ranting about that quote, which, as somebody who has drafted many a press release in his day, I will say I actually side with Vince McMahon on that quote. That quote was pretty fucking terrible. I mean, that's like one of those dear leader quotes. So I don't blame him for that. But Raw that night at the Staples Center opened with a painfully unfunny skit in the ring with Vince McMahon and a Stan Kroenke impersonator, which included Vince making fun of Kroenke's first name, Enos. Stan, I guess, is his middle name, but he goes by Stan Kroenke, but Enos is his first name, and he called Kroenke an Enos. He was fixated on this. You're an Enos! He's a fucking man-child. Look no further than this segment. He is a fucking man-child. I mean, we already knew that, but I give you Exhibit A. So he called him an Enos a whole bunch of times, and then he shoved the Kroenke impersonator down to the mat. The fans in Los Angeles, they cheered this because it's cheap heat when their team is playing Denver. But I think unless you lived in one of those two cities, I doubt anybody gave two shits about any of this. This just felt like one long therapy session that we all had to sit through on TV. The main event was a 10-man tag with the babyfaces wrestling in Lakers jerseys going over the heels, wearing Nuggets jerseys, of course. But the match was noteworthy for another reason. Ken Kennedy had made his return to television that night after shoulder surgery as part of the babyface squad. He was tagging with John Cena and Batista, MVP, and Jerry Lawler. During the match, Kennedy dropped Randy Orton on the back of his neck on a back suplex, and Orton was not happy about it. And just 4 days later, Vince McMahon made the call to fire Mr. Kennedy. Months later, in an interview with the Pro Wrestling Report, Kennedy had this to say about it. When I got to the building, I ran up behind him being Randy Orton, and I gave him a big bear hug from behind, and he treated me like I was just an acquaintance of his. And then he made such a big stink about me, supposedly dropping him on his head. He literally blew up in front of all the talent. He didn't literally blow up. Fucking idiot. Yes, Randy Orton literally exploded. Anyway, said Randy Orton blew up in front of all the talent, including Vince and Stephanie, and began to lecture me about how I had to be careful and how his health was very important. It just didn't make any sense to me. Randy jumped really, really hard. In wrestling, it's give and take. It was a matter of either I drop him on his head or I help him through this. His neck never even touched the mat, which makes me wonder why he even went to the trainer's room to get his neck taped up. He was so injured that he went on to wrestle 3 nights in Mexico. Randy Orton, not one to leave this alone, later responded on a Randy Orton fan message board. It's like a message board forum dedicated to Randy Orton that no longer exists. But apparently he would post there. I vaguely remember this. He would occasionally pop in there and post. I think the moderators had confirmed previously that whenever he would post there, it was the real Randy Orton. And Orton had posted about the birth of one of his children and some other stuff in the past. So anyway, Orton supposedly posted this. He is in denial. He thinks that you have to be able to do a moonsault to know how to work. And as for dropping me on my head, he did. He never got to see all 4 camera angles of him doing it. I did. Plus, the left side of my neck down to my trap was sore all week in Mexico. I did tell Ken that he shouldn't be dropping me on my head with such a simple, basic move. He never said sorry, and even called me a liar after the match. I remember looking at him in disbelief. And yes, I did tell management that I did not want to work with him after that. Who wouldn't? There's another thing. Never did I get my neck taped, as he claims that I did in that interview that he did. Also, the whole bear hug story does have some truth to it. Early in the day that morning in LA, he came up behind me and grabbed me around my chest and picked me up off the floor. I don't know anyone who enjoys being tackled from behind and picked up off the floor. When he let go and I realized that it was Ken, I was like, oh, okay, you're back. Cool. My reaction of his big return was watered down, and I found it very funny reading in his interview that he felt like I had an agenda, or almost like I wanted him gone. Not until I was given a belly-to-back suplex onto the back of my neck did I have any negative feelings with Mr. Anderson. I honestly hope for his wife's sake that he can find something else he's marginally good at and earn a living. I know he really wants to entertain, so good luck, Ken. You're gonna need it. Wow. A little salty Orton there. As I recall, a lot of people had it out for Kennedy around that time. I think John Cena and Shawn Michaels may have also complained to management at one point about him. And the Orton thing was just the final straw for Vince McMahon. And I also don't think they were very happy with him. He had done some media interview, something about steroids. I don't know if it was a radio interview or a TV interview where it almost sounded like he was defending the use of steroids. And the point is, I think Vince McMahon probably just used this as exactly the incident that he needed to get rid of somebody that he already didn't like and wanted to get rid of. He was looking for a reason, and this was the perfect reason for him to just shit-can the guy. 9 years ago this week, on May 24th, 2012, there was nearly an international incident in Brazil involving Chris Jericho at a WWE live event from Sao Paulo. The main event was CM Punk defending his WWE title against Jericho. Punk came to the ring waving a Brazilian flag that a fan had handed to him. And after he put it down, Jericho told referee Mike Chioda to hand the flag to him. And he proceeded to drop it on the ground and stomp on it multiple times to get heel heat. About 5 minutes into the match, Charles Robinson, who was not the referee for the match, but he comes running down to the ring and he tells Jericho, stop the match. You need to apologize for kicking the flag. If you don't apologize, you're going to be arrested. And Jericho looked up and he saw a group of armed Brazilian soldiers swarming the aisleway. And all of a sudden, Johnny Ace, who was on that tour, I think this may have been the first ever WWE show in Brazil. So maybe they sent him, you know, because it was a special show. But anyway, John Laurinaitis was there. He comes out. He's waving his arms around. He's yelling that Jericho needs to apologize right now. This is not a joke. I mean, he is as serious as a heart attack. So Jericho realizes now the gravity of the situation. Punk, meanwhile, he's down selling. Jericho grabs the house mic in the middle of this match. And he says, I would never purposely disrespect Brazil or its beautiful flag. I did it to entertain you. And I want to sincerely apologize to everybody in the arena and in the entire country of Brazil. I'm sorry. And with that, they finish their match. So they go to the back after it's over. Dean Malenko was the agent. He tells Jericho that one of the older soldiers, who Jericho could see, is just staring a hole through him. Malenko says, that guy, he wants to arrest you, like right now. He was so infuriated, he thought the whole thing was real. He thought the whole thing was a shoot. So Jericho, he says, I better text Vince and just let him know what's going on here. He texts Vince McMahon that he upset the Brazilian army by kicking their flag, and he promised Vince he would never do it again on any of the future tours. According to Jericho in his book, Vince texted him back immediately and said there would be no more Brazilian tours for him or for any of them. WWE will no longer be allowed to perform in Brazil in the future. WTF, Chris. That was his message. Jericho said that he had done stuff like that dozens of times before. What's the big deal? He said Vince was furious. Texted back. He goes, it was effing stupid. When was the last time I allowed this kind of shit? 1985? Go home, you're suspended. We will talk when you get back to the U.S. Thanks for ruining what would have been a great market for us. Who knows how this is going to hurt us elsewhere? And what Jericho didn't realize is that kicking the flag is a felony in Brazil. Take that very, very seriously. And Vince McMahon felt that not just to try to save, I guess, the Brazilian market, but also other international markets as well, he had to be forceful. He had to have this, you know, publicly strong reaction, which is why he suspended Jericho. The announcement went up on WWE.com that Jericho had been suspended for 30 days. And Jericho was pissed that Vince didn't tell him first about the length of the suspension. He just went and announced it. And Vince was like, oh, I didn't mean for it to get out early. The website people put it up before we gave them permission to do so. And of course, Jericho didn't believe that. But McMahon was worried that something might happen to him. So he told him, look, fly out of the country with the rest of the crew. I think the next stop was in Ecuador. Fly to Ecuador. And from Ecuador, you'll fly home. Do not get separated from the rest of the crew. That's how worried he was that something might happen to Jericho. Or that he might get thrown into a Brazilian jail. Don't get separated from the crew. Meanwhile, he does tell a story about at the airport. They did separate him at one point from the crew. They took him to like this empty hangar at the airport. And they asked him to forfeit his passport. Which he did, because what the fuck is he going to say? No. But that's where he started to get, you know, really worried. And, you know, 10 minutes later, they came back and they were going through his bags and they gave him his passport back and they let him, you know, they let him fly out of there. But, yeah, he said for a while it was pretty scary. And once he got on the plane, he texted Vince to thank him for checking up on him. And he says Vince McMahon texted him back and said, I love you, you idiot. AC/DC, still the best band. 7 years ago this week, on May 29th, 2014, WWE aired its first ever NXT TakeOver show from Full Sail University. This was the company's second live NXT special on the brand new, at the time, WWE Network. After the NXT Arrival show in February, that was not a takeover. Takeover did not start until May. On the show, Charlotte Flair, with Ric Flair in her corner, beat Natalya, with Bret the Hitman Hart in hers, to win the vacant NXT Women's Championship in an excellent match. Probably, you know, even after all these years, I mean, we've had a lot of really good women's matches since then. That was around the time they started to finally take the women's division, or just women's wrestling in general, more seriously than they really ever had before in company history. I mean, you can use their buzzwords if you want to, the women's revolution or the women's evolution. You can call it whatever the fuck you want. This really was the beginnings of it with these women in NXT, Charlotte, Bayley, Becky, Sasha. And this match was, at the time, regarded as one of the best women's matches in company history. And probably would still be pretty high up on a lot of people's lists. It's a very good match. Same night, Natty's husband Tyson Kidd lost to Adrian Neville in the main event for the NXT Championship. I love that run that Natty and TJ had down there in NXT, especially Tyson Kidd. He was killing it down there with the matches that he was having with Neville and with Tyler Breeze and a lot of the, maybe Sami Zayn, I think, as well, you know, a lot of those guys, just really, really good stuff. And then when he got called back up to the main roster, he started tagging with Cesaro. And of course, they started to build some momentum as a tag team. And then the following year came the injury in the match with Samoa Joe. And that was it. His in-ring career was over. He has not had a match since. And 2 years ago this week, on May 25th, 2019, All Elite Wrestling hosts its very first pay-per-view event titled Double or Nothing. From the MGM Grand in Las Vegas, nearly all of the 11,000 tickets they put on sale were gone. 3 months before, in a pre-sale, they went in less than half an hour. Not too shabby for a supposed t-shirt company. There was a real hunger for an alternative to WWE's product. Now, whether you think it's enough of a real alternative, here we are 2 years later, right? Whether or not you think AEW is really this great alternative to WWE is up for debate. The one thing that is not up for debate, whether you like AEW or not, competition is never a bad thing. I was at that show, third row ringside. I had a blast. I had the Cody and Dustin Rhodes match as the match of the night. Some people might say Young Bucks against the Lucha Bros. Young Bucks retained their AAA tag team titles over Penta and Rey Fénix. Chris Jericho pinned Kenny Omega in the main event, which was not as good as their Tokyo Dome match. Or I should say, as Marv Albert called him during one of the NBA games leading up to this pay-per-view, when they were promoting it, Marv Albert called him Chris Jericho. How the fuck do you screw up that name? Of all the names to screw up, Jericho? How does that happen? After the match, the debuting Jon Moxley appeared from out of the crowd to attack both Jericho and Omega to close out the show. Tonight, as I am recording this, is their third Double or Nothing show, and the first one is still the only one to actually be held in Vegas. Here's hoping they can make it back there in 2022. And that is this week in wrestling history. If you have mailbag questions, you can always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Again, if you are part of our family on the YouTube channel, if you are a YouTube channel member at either tier, there is a post up in the community section. Go check it out. You can drop a question in there that I might use for my next members-only Q&A video that'll be going up a little bit later this week. And I thank all of you for your patronage on there. Ultimate Warrior, I'm going to be doing a double review for Dark Side of the Ring and A&E. That should be going up in the next day or two on the YouTube channel. And of course, tonight, as soon as Double or Nothing is over and the pay-per-view goes off the air, I will be live on YouTube recapping the entire show and also hosting the Wrestle Rumble Great American Belt Bash contest. We're giving away 5 championship belt replicas tonight at random. So get those entries in before 8 p.m. Eastern. It's only a buck to enter. WrestleRumble.com is the place to go. We'll have some fun tonight heading into the Memorial Day tomorrow. I sound like Bret Hart now. The Memorial Day. It's like the WCW. The SummerSlam. But now, if you are stateside, I hope you have a great Memorial Day. Cook up some hot dogs and hamburgers. Happy grilling for those of you who are planning to do so. Hopefully get nice weather. Nicer than it's been here in New York. It's supposed to get nicer tomorrow. Finally, but it's been a total washout. I got a leak in my roof downstairs in the living room. I got 2 buckets there. It's raining all day. I can't have anybody up on the roof or the guy will fucking fall. So I got a leaky roof now I got to worry about. It's always something, man. It's always something. How come Vince McMahon never had a roofer gimmick in WWE? I'm sure there were a lot of wrestlers who used to slip roofies, but I mean like a roofer, right? We had a dentist. We had a plumber. We had a garbage man. We had all kinds of crazy, wacky gimmicks. We never had a roofer or a carpenter. All right, I'm babbling now. Episode 707, that's when I'm going to be back with you for the podcast next Sunday. Again, please let me know if you have any issues with Apple. I'm hoping it's all worked out. But again, I do this on purpose when I make sure that the show is pushed out to all of the different platforms that it is. If you can't get it on Apple, if Apple is lagging behind, you don't want to wait. There's always Stitcher or Spotify or Pandora or TuneIn or Podbean or iHeart. There's so many different ways to listen to the podcast. I know if it's not your preferred way, it sucks. But there's always a way to stay connected to the show. And I want to thank all of you for doing so each and every week. Be well, stay safe, have a great holiday. I'll see you later tonight. And again for 707 next Sunday. Take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
The great Kali. When I think back to all those Kali moments, I mean, we've got the, well, you know, there was the time that he, who can forget that great, you know, how about I just share a story? Big Show sees Kali walk in. He says, "Hey, motherfucker, why do you keep stealing my spots? That's bullshit. You can't even do any of it properly anyway because you're the fucking shits."
The Solomonster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster sounds off.